All right, good morning. That's so good. We're in Romans chapter 2, and I've got some chapter questions I'm going to hand out. I just forgot to bring them. We ran them off this morning, and Bo's going to get those for you. That will kind of help, just like we did with chapter 1, and we'll do that with every chapter, just some primary things to get. And some of this all of that we'll cover in class, but I don't know if we'll cover all of these questions today. If we don't, then what I would encourage you to do is just go back and as you read through and you feel like you have an answer. Some of the questions are fairly simple. I think nobody would have a problem if you read through Romans chapter 2. Some of them, are a little bit more involved, you know, it's not, the answer is there, but you may have to read it and think for a minute. It won't be just an immediate answer, but hopefully that will help us all, go through the chapter and kind of keep the theme of the book, in mind. So Wade and Bo are going to be handing those out. And if we don't cover something in class and you go, I've read, I just don't have an idea. You've got one of two choices. Either you can just come to me and ask me about it, we can talk about it. Or you can just wait till we cover it in class and we'll hopefully get there. But I think they'll be helpful to everybody. Okay. We've talked a lot about Romans chapter 1. As we come into Romans chapter 2, and fundamentally, we covered the first 11 or so verses of Romans chapter 2. Do you remember what happens in Romans, the second chapter? What Paul does? I mean, there's several answers to this question, but go ahead, Daryl. It does. Right. I read back through last night just the first three chapters of Romans in detail. It's interesting when you come from Romans chapter 1, which overall clearly seems to be indicating Gentile sins. What even the Jews would have understood to be Gentile sins. When you come to Romans chapter 2 and you pick up in verse 1, do you think when they first would have seen that part of the writing that the Jew who's hearing this or reading this would just say, oh, okay, now he's talking about us? Not yet. It's a very smooth transition. This is so much like Paul to kind of, he gets you to agreeing with him, number one, and then he kind of pulls you into this thing and you're thinking, okay, this is much like Jesus. The application to the Gentiles, they certainly need grace, don't they? And then you come into what verse when it's just explicit that he's talking about the Jews? 17 is the one where he really like targets a Jewish audience. Now, there's something that happens though before this. And remember, we talked a little bit about Paul's diatribes, which is just where he has a hypothetical person he seems to be responding to. And that response is to teach us something. So it's not that there necessarily is actually a person, but if people weren't saying or thinking this, it wouldn't make sense to have a hypothetical opponent from a literary standpoint. So as he's moving through this, in Romans chapter 2 and verse 1, after Romans 1 has dealt with all these things, he is going to switch from the third person plural to the second plural in this kind of diatribe style. And he begins to confront what you might think of as some kind of imaginary opponent of some kind. And we read this, but in verse 1 he says, therefore, you have no excuse. Now let me stop you right there. Therefore, you have no excuse. Have we seen that language before, even in chapter 1? That they had Did he say that about the Gentiles? Sure, yeah. I mean, you back up. Why did he say the Gentiles were without excuse? Right. Right, that's right. That's right. So they were without excuse from the standpoint, not that they would understand everything about God from looking at trees in the sky. That's not his point. God had made efforts, by the way, through prophets to Gentiles as well as the Jews. But Bo's right. The concept is that this denial of any authority over you, any God at all, or just ignoring God, that even his creation demonstrates his divine attributes, okay? Now, that was what he said about the Gentiles. But when you come here to Romans 2, he says, therefore you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge do the same thing. Who does that sound like? Who else said that kind of thing? Jesus. Remember in his Sermon on the Mount, that sounds like Matthew 7:1, when he's telling the Jewish leadership of his day, that their hypercritical and hypocritical judgment is sinful. You remember that? Judge not lest you be judged, for in the way you judge will be measured to you. And he talks about the mote and the beam and all that kind of stuff. Well, here he says, therefore you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge do the same things. Well, that wouldn't be talking about the Gentiles, would it? The Gentiles were not claiming any kind of great, you know, overall, I'm speaking fairly stereotypically, but overall, generally, they weren't claiming to be great moral guides the way the Jews did, the way the Jewish leadership of Jesus' day and now later on in Paul's day claimed. Verse 2, though, he says, but we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against those who practice such things. And do you think this, O man, that you who judge those who do such things and do the same, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you despise the riches of his goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God leads you to repentance? But in accordance with your hardness and your impenitent heart, you are treasuring up for yourself wrath in the day of wrath and revelation of the righteous judgment of God, who will render to each one according to his deeds. To those who by patient continuance in doing good seek for glory, honor, and immortality, eternal life. But to those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish on every soul of man. Now, here, when he says on every soul of man, that would be Jew and Gentile. Okay, that's everybody. So there is some indication that the Jews would be into this application. So he says, this is for everybody. And then he says, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Where else in Romans did we see that language? The Jew first and also to the Greek. This is kind of interesting. What'd you say? Chapter 1. Now, when he's talking about to the Jew first and also to the Greek in chapter 1 in verses 16 and 17, what is he speaking about? What'd you say? The gospel. We're talking about the provision of forgiveness and grace and the opportunity for faith and all of these things. But now here in Romans 2, what is he talking about when he uses the same kind of phrase? What is he talking about here when he says to the Jew first and also to the Greek? Yeah, I mean, the judgment of God. Now remember when we talked about the passive judgment of God where God allows us to taste the fruits of our sin and that kind of thing? This is the active judgment of God. This is God pouring out his wrath on those who've rejected Christ and rejected the truth. And now again he says, the Jew first and also to the Greek. Now one of the things interesting about that, there was a blessing in the gospel going to the Jew and then to the Greek, but also there's responsibility involved. He's going to come back to that idea, and I don't know that I've always picked up on that, but he's going to come back to that idea at the beginning of chapter 3, when he's going to say, well, you know, they might be saying, well, if salvation is for the Jew and the Gentile, what advantage is there in us having what? Or in being what? A Jew. Why be a Jew? Why, I mean, what advantage is there? And he's going to come back and say, well, you have the oracles of God. But with God's oracles comes responsibility. And we'll talk more about that. But this line, the Jew first, also to the Greek regarding the gospel. And then again, the Jew first and also the Greek regarding the judgment of God is significant when you get to chapter 3. So that's just one of those things you can put in your pocket. When we come back, you'll go, oh yeah, I remember that. That's significant as you move through this whole line on the Jew first and also the Greek. Yeah. 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 When they think he's talking about them, it's okay, but he's going to bring it home. That's right. But I want you to just try to pick up on these things. And so, again, when we talked about chapter 1, verses 18 through 32, there's a lot of highlighted things that really seem to kind of come off the page, I'm sure, even for the Jewish hearer. Yeah, that's those Gentiles. Yeah, that's those Gentiles. But there were sins in that list that they had problems too with. He's going to come back to that in chapter 2, if I can get this to... Okay. Chapter 2 and verses 3 and 4, again, is strengthening... And this is the basic point in chapter 2. He's strengthening his argument against the Jewish overconfidence. Okay, that's the problem. They view Gentiles over here and us as over here as the Jews. And there were, even though he's writing to Jewish believers, they also have the problem of Jews who are rejecting Christ, not thinking they need it. The Gentiles might need something, but we don't need anything else. Okay. And you see that in verses 3 and 4. Now, before we go on, and we're going to talk some about this today. We've talked about ethnic kind of boundary markers for the Jews. In their mind, the things that separated them from the Gentiles. Which, by the way, I think is the primary idea that is being used when we talk about works when we get further on into Romans. I think that's how Paul's using the term. But what were some of those things? And he's going to come right on out and say it in chapter 2. But what were some of the... Does everybody know what I mean by boundary markers? You know, these are the distinguishing things about us that distinguish us or separate us from the Gentiles. So we have a special... Okay, circumcision we know is a big one. Okay, primary controversy in the entire New Testament... Between the Jews and the Gentiles, see it in Galatians heavily. Those in Acts 15, remember they got together there. We've talked about this background of the whole New Testament, I really think, is the issue over circumcision. It's not that did the apostles teach that it was wrong for somebody to go be circumcised? No. But what was the problem? Those who were doing what regarding circumcision? Yeah, binding it. As a matter of salvation, you couldn't, in other words, the Gentile has to become a Jew before he can become a Christian. Okay, so that was the issue. That's a serious boundary marker for the Jewish ethnic. This is what you have to realize. It's not necessarily the Jews were saying no Gentiles can come in. It's that they were saying they have to come in our way. Okay, I think sometimes we have the idea there's a sense in which they're second class citizens. They've got to come through. They've got to become a proselyte. They've got to be like us. They've got to be part of our community. And everything that they had ever been taught had taught them that. But this is the way salvation was going to work. And now they're hearing something different. So certainly circumcision is one. And what, for the Jew thinking rightly, what is circumcision to be a sign of? It's not just the physical act. Huh? Yes, of course, with Abraham, it was a sign of the covenant with God. So they have the idea of covenant with God over here, and then everybody who's a Gentile is outside of that covenant. It was a very simple proposition for them. Okay? And so he's been talking about the sins of those outside of the covenant. But now he's about to talk about those who consider themselves to be in the covenant. Roger, what were you saying a minute ago? Yes. Well, but here's what you have to see about that, and you're right, is that when I said circumcision was a sign of the covenant, it is an important part that in their mind represented the covenant and the law. If you look at Acts chapter 15, somebody turn over there and read. I think it's verse 10. There's a phrase there that helps us along this line. And they're talking about circumcision, and the apostles have gathered together about this. Let's see if I can find it here. Hang on. No, it's where he mentions circumcision and the keeping. There it is, verse 5. Look there in verse 5, Acts 15, 5. But some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed rose up saying, it is necessary to circumcise them and to what? Command them to keep the law of Moses. So we're not really just talking about circumcision. We're talking about them having to keep the law of Moses. So in their idea, even if we accept Christ as Messiah, it's still the law. We have to keep the law. And the fact that someone could, here's where this gets real significant. The fact that someone that's a Gentile could become a Christian and not be circumcised. The only way for that to be possible is if we're no longer under the law. You see that? So it's not just the circumcision. They're so upset because it means we're no longer under the law. So in the same context, for instance, in Galatians chapter 3, when Paul is talking about circumcision and all of that, and circumcision avails nothing, he comes back and shows that the promise of Abraham of salvation can be received and experienced by people who are not circumcised, and that the law was a schoolmaster or tutor to bring us unto Christ, but once we've come to Christ, we don't have to be under the schoolmaster any longer. So this is a big deal to the Jewish mind. I mean, you talk about shock and awe. This is kind of shocking because they haven't fully understood the purpose in the law, that the law had fulfilled its purpose, but it was to bring us to Christ, and then we no longer have to be under the law. Alan, what were you going to say? You mean with the proselyte, for instance? Yeah. That's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, within the Jewish community, you have at least kind of three, there's probably more than this, but three categories. You have those who were flesh and blood descendants, and of course they were circumcised, that was a sign of the covenant. You have people, can you think of significant people in the Old Testament that would have been proselytes though, that came into the community, that would have done what the law said? That had been Gentiles prior. Rahab's probably one of the, and there's other examples. What was Ruth's national descent? Moabite. Yeah, Moabites. And so we have some examples of people, but they still came into the community that way. Now they did have what's called strangers and foreigners. If you go back and read from Exodus and others, those who would surrender and acquiesce and cooperate, they had responsibilities to those people. But, of course, they were not considered full-fledged members of the community or anything like that. Okay, so, yeah, the answer is yes, to a point. But there is a lot of emphasis upon, in their minds, national descent. And that's what makes it so important when you come to Galatians and you're being told, well, Romans 9 even, when we get there, where he's going to say, not all Israel's Israel. Okay, not just because you're physically a descendant doesn't mean that you're fitting that remnant language, which I don't think they understood that. And so that, this is why Romans is so important, I think, in the New Testament, because a lot of that is fleshed out. Okay. So we know circumcision, we know keeping the law, and with the law would come what else? Yeah, you know, everything else. From a personal standpoint, the Jew, what would he do? Well, he would have dietary restrictions. Okay. Now, Romans 14, that's going to be an issue. Because you've got these boundary markers. Well, when you come to Romans 2, though, early on, if you look at Romans 2, he's gonna get into all of this, and he says in the, you know, you've been overconfident, and Paul's gonna come head on this issue of circumcision now that we know everything that would have represented in the Jewish mind. Well, what was the problem wasn't that they'd been circumcised. The problem was how they viewed themselves. And so, you know, it's as if Paul is warning the Jew, you know, do you think because you're separated from the Gentiles by the covenant and circumcision that you can violate the covenant without consequence? You see the Gentiles in your mind is violating the moral law under which he should have been living. Well, what about you? You talk about this idea that you've been circumcised and that you're under this covenant and you're this and you're that. But have you not violated the covenant? Have you held true to the covenant? Do you really have any place to say that you're not a sinner as well as the Gentile is a sinner? And so you, chapter 2 and verse 5, is going to be important in Romans in this covenant circumcision and the purpose of it and that kind of thing. Now let me ask you this, because sometimes I hear people say things that's interesting to me. Did God ever intend on this command to be circumcised, which was a sign of the covenant, to only be a fleshly thing? Had God always wanted there to be, if we can call it, a circumcision of the heart? Can you think of a passage that would show us that? There's a few. Can you think of a passage? Because a lot of people have the idea, well, in the Old Testament, God just, and I've heard brethren say this, and this is just as wrong as it can be, you know, God just cared about, you know, the outward, ceremonial, physical, but when we come to the new covenant, you know, God cares about the heart. Well, God's always cared about the heart, because there were some things that foreshadowed of the new covenant. In the old covenant, doesn't mean that he was indifferent about the heart. What do you got, Kelsey? It's a good point. Good point. Daryl? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it wasn't that the sacrifices don't matter, but without the heart, they don't matter. Okay, we're going to go there. That's right there. You're right. But some people will try to say that's just the new covenant, which is not true. Now, he's talking about the new covenant there. But can you think of anything that specifically mentions the circumcision of the heart or anything like that that would go along with those other verses we've just thought of? In the Old Testament. In the Old Testament. Now, Colossians 2, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Because I think sometimes we have this idea that the circumcision of the heart was just in the new covenant. Hey, that's good. Read it. Hang on. There you go. Okay, let's hang on. Did everybody hear what was that verse again? Deuteronomy 30, verse 6. God's interested in the circumcision of the heart. Have you got, Kelton, do you have Deuteronomy 10, verse 16? Could you read that? Okay. Somebody read Jeremiah 4:4, if that's the right passage, and I hope it is. Anybody else want to read for me? Okay, very good. So you got all these passages. Yeah, they're talking about circumcision. But circumcision was an expression of the circumcision. The physical circumcision was an expression of the circumcision of the heart. If you don't have a circumcision of the heart, that doesn't even matter. Okay, now Paul, when he gets into Romans 2, basically, we would say here in Arkansas, before you get up on your high horse about this, and you start looking at all these Gentiles, you might want to ask yourself how you've done with the covenant. Now, were there some Jews who had been very conscientious? Yes. But had there been plenty of violations of the covenant? Sure. Okay. Which, this is selective memory. You know, we're just not going to, we can see their sins, but not ours. So when we talk about the circumcision of the heart, now this is interesting because in the Old Testament, circumcision of the heart, circumcision of the heart, you come to the New Testament, and Mike mentioned Romans 2. He's going to say, for he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. So we no longer have to worry about physical circumcision. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and the circumcision is that which is of the heart by the Spirit, not by the letter. Now, you'll see that in other places. When he says by the Spirit revealed the gospel, not by the letter. What would that reference? The Mosaical law, the Torah. So, and his praise is not from men, but from God. Here's the point. To truly have your heart circumcised, you have to believe in Christ. You have to be a Christian. And that's why that language of when we're buried with Christ in baptism, Christ circumcises or cuts away the sin. See? So it's interesting that here's how he's flipping it on him. Here somebody is, they say, well, I've been circumcised and the Gentile hasn't. Yeah, but if the Gentile is a Christian and you're rejecting Christ, actually the truth is he's been circumcised and you haven't. His heart has been circumcised. Has your heart been circumcised? Now he's going to develop this even more when you back up in Romans 2 that I want you to see. And he gives them, if you look in verse 5, and this is a play on a common phrase, usually we think of storing up life through faithfulness to God, but he says those who reject Christ, they're storing up what? What are they storing up for themselves? How do you store up wrath against the day of wrath? What do you think he means, Alan? Right. So your overconfidence and your self-righteousness and all of these things, and this is similar when you go back to the Old Testament, the prophets were trying to prophesy to them and tell them what was going to happen, and they would say, no, that's not going to happen because we have the temple. We've got the temple here. And so that shows that God's pleased with us. And the prophets were going, no, that doesn't prove anything. And of course, eventually, even the temple was dealt with. And they had to go off into captivity. And so, he's emphasizing the impartiality of God. Look at chapter 2 and verse 6. He says, God will render judgment according to works. According to what we have done. So let's look at this and just kind of, I tried to separate these out. If you look at the first 11 verses, on one side you have the one rejecting Christ and on the other side you have the faithful Christian, Jew or Gentile on either side. Jew first, but also the Greek or Gentile. So he speaks of those who have been stubborn and had an unrepentant heart. He says they were storing up wrath. They were selfishly ambitious. They did not obey the truth, but unrighteousness, Jew or Gentile. Okay. On the other side, he just goes back and forth with this. He mentions the one who repents, the one who perseveres in doing good, who seeks for glory and honor and immortality, eternal life. And then he says glory, honor, and peace for those who do good. So it's not about whether you were physically circumcised or not physically circumcised. It's about the circumcision of your heart. And it's about you seeking God. Okay, now we mentioned this. This comes out in Romans 2. Oh, I didn't go that far. And let's read this together. Romans 2, verses 12. Let's read, I tell you what, I want to read the rest of it. Let's begin in verse 12. Romans 2 and verse 12. Somebody would read verses 12 through 20, and someone else can read verses 21 through 29. Who would, Xavier, can you do 12 through 20? Austin Brown, can you do 21 through 29, please? Thank you. This is real quick. Later on in Romans, you're going to see the contrast between flesh and spirit. It would do well to go ahead and note in Romans 2 that flesh, he's talking about the works of the law and circumcision and that kind of thing. He's talking about justification and attitude towards yourself and not being overconfident, that kind of thing. So later on, when we get into what he means by the works of the flesh, that might give some insight into that. Now, we have this language here. It's pretty interesting what Paul does. He mentions those who were without the law, and then he mentions those who were under the law. And by the law here, it should not be interpreted as any law. But when he says, when he speaks, for instance, of those who were under the law, what law are we talking about? The law of Moses. The law of Moses. And that's very clear what they would consider their Torah. Okay. When he speaks of those who are without the law, he speaks of the Gentiles, doesn't he? It does not mean that there was no law under which they were to live or they could not have been guilty of sin. Okay. Because sin is the transgression of what? The law. If you don't have any law, and Romans 5 is explicit about this, if you're under no law at all, there is nothing to violate. Okay. And yet we know the Gentiles were guilty of sin. I believe they were under a moral law of God. Go ahead. Yes. Yes. Never a time. That's right. Yeah. That's right. What were you going to say, Brother? I won't come back to what Daryl said, Brother Hale. That's somewhat of a different matter, but it's related. You're right. And we're going to come back to that, but you're right about that. I know where you're going with that. Back to what Daryl said. You know, sometimes when I tell people I don't believe that we are under the Ten Commandments, but I believe all of the moral precepts that you find in the Ten Commandments are in the New Covenant or say in the New Covenant. I've had people, on the radio program, people call and say, well, you don't believe to lead moral lives? You don't think it's a sin to lie and do all of this? And of course I would say, no, those things are sinful. The New Covenant is very clear about those things. But those things were wrong before the Ten Commandments were given in written form. So really the same thing you're saying about someone who understands that although we're not under the Ten Commandments, that was for Israel, that we're under the New Covenant and there are moral precepts there, you need to answer your own question. Do you think that prior to the giving of the Ten Commandments on the Mount to Moses, that it was okay to lie, that it was okay? No, of course not. And there it was, what we consider the patriarchal law. And you know, have you seen those charts where you have like the patriarchal law, and then you have the Mosaical system, and then you have the Christian dispensation. And I know what we're trying to do with that. It's not quite that simple. Okay, like, there's a sense in which you could see that in the Jewish system. But what about the Gentiles? The Gentiles' patriarchal moral law, I think if the chart were done right, keeps going for a good while. So, and I think that's what he's referencing in Romans chapter 2. Okay, we'll come back to that. But there was never a time when man's not under a law and there's all kinds of consequences of saying that there was no law at all or no law principle. But his point is, okay, you have this confidence because you were under the law. Well, have you kept the law? Have you kept the law, the Mosaical law? Have you kept it? Have you kept the covenant? Here were some people that were without the law. That is, they didn't have the written code that you have. They didn't have the Mosaical law, and yet, and you have to keep this in context, there were occasions in which they, because they had some moral sensitivity about things, were actually keeping the law that you have without having it better than you were keeping what you had. Now, you have to balance this out. Was that true just across the board? Well, apparently not, because we have Romans 1. 18 through 32, which talks about all those Gentile sins. But his point is, you know, you look down on the Gentile, but there were occasions in which he did better. If we really, you know, looked at that specific, he did better with what he didn't have than what you did with what you did have. If that makes sense. And what he's doing in all of this is he's undercutting Jewish overconfidence. He's saying, look, you've sinned. You've violated the covenant. You have no right to be so judgmental toward all of this. Your sins may have had different packaging, but they were all the same, a violation of the covenant. Cadet, what did you say? Yeah. Well, and this was hard. You remember along with Cornelius, you remember the centurion in Matthew chapter 8, and he believes Jesus can heal his servant. Do you remember what Christ said to the Jewish audience that would have heard? In all of Israel. And then he says that they will come from the east and the west, which is, I think he's talking about Gentiles, and they will sit down at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And John the Baptist says about all those sinners that they were condemning him for talking to, that they're pressing into the kingdom and that they would get, they were, he says, they're nearer the kingdom than you are, talking to the Jews. And so this is the same kind of thing that he's doing here in Romans chapter 2. Now, when he talks about the argument that they became a law to themselves, you'll just notice there, you need to be careful about not saying in every case this was the case of the Gentiles, but there were occasions. But he's using this to undercut the Jewish overconfidence. And so he says, in verse 14, "For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them." And then he says, Jesus will judge all things on the last day. And then in the next 2 or 3 minutes that we have, remember, this is all about removing overconfidence. And I think there's a lot of application for us on this. There's a lot of application for us. Now, let me move on. We've covered that. Okay. Remember we were talking about those boundary markers? Look there in verses 17. We read it. If you look down from verse 17 through verse 27, he tightens it in. If you look at Romans 2, it's like he throws out the rope and he tightens it and he tightens it and he tightens a little bit more. And undercutting this, and you have to look at it this way. There was a nationalistic, ethnic / religious arrogance that in the Jewish mind he had had for a long time and didn't realize it. And so there's a lot to unwrap here. So we're talking about those boundary markers. Look at chapter 2 and look at verse 17. If you bear the name Jew, now when he says Jew, I don't think he's just talking about your race. In the Jewish mind, when he says, you call yourself a Jew, what do you think he's saying? Yeah, there's a religious kind of superiority that he feels. And in a sense, there was a time in which he might have had the right to feel it up to a point, but not in a self-righteous way. And so he says, you call yourself a Jew, and then what's next? He says, and you rely upon what? The law. Now, in relying on the law, what was he saying? How did the Jew feel? I keep the law. He doesn't, I do. And then he says, not only that, and you boast in God. You see, I have the covenant relationship, not you. And if you don't do what I did, you don't get in. Verse 18, and know his will. And approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind and a light to those who are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of the immature, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and of the truth. And then he goes down through this text, and you know what kinds of sins that looks like? In verse 21 and verse 22, and in verse 23, look at those sins. What list does that look like it should belong in that we've already covered in Romans 1? Looks like Gentile sins. So all of that stuff in Romans 1, while the Gentiles need to hear it, I believe is setting up what he's going to do in Romans 2. Now, do you think that the Jews were guilty of literally coming into temples and robbing them? No. This is the kind of sacrilege that the prophets speak of when God says, I don't want their worship anymore. I want to shut the doors. I don't want that. The superficial nature of this, the hypocritical nature of this, the lack of genuineness in this was sacrilege to him. It was like somebody coming in and robbing the temples. And then he mentions moral purity, which remember that was a keynote, Gentile problem in their minds. And then he says in verse 23, you who boast in the law through your breaking the law, do you dishonor God? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, just as it is written, for indeed circumcision is of value if you practice the law, but if you are a transgressor of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. So if the uncircumcised man keeps the requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? And he who is physically uncircumcised, if he keeps the law, will he not judge you, who though having the letter of the law and circumcision are a transgressor of the law? He's setting it all up for it's all about the heart. Now before you leave, real quick. Where'd it go? Just give me 1 minute. Okay. These last 2 points and then we'll be done. The people of Israel were boasting in being God's chosen nation and how they had rested and depended on the covenant. However, what had happened in their history? Why had their land been wasted that God had promised to them? Why had they been taken off into captivity? Why had Jerusalem been destroyed? Why had the Jews been taken into exile in the first place? Sin. So they need grace, just like the Gentiles do. Okay, we'll stop there.